The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Infracell up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And I'm here this week with Neil Ross. Neil Ross is a voice actor you know who has done Pidge, he's done Keith, and he's done various other voices on Vehicle Voltron. He's also worked on Fleet of Doom and also the Voltron the Third Dimension. So I want you to give a warm welcome to Mr. Neil Ross.
And all I can say at this point is, let's form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Infracells up. Mega thrusters are go. Let's go, Voltron Force. Form feet and legs. Form arms and torso. And I'll form the tachus. Oh, wait a minute. I think I got one of those lines wrong.
Yeah, that's okay.
Figure out which one it was.
I think everybody else knows. Yeah. Everybody who listens to this podcast is a huge Voltron fan. So over the years, obviously, you know, you've done this. How many times have you said those lines?
I shudder to think. they were in just about every episode, as I recall. And so if that's true, I must have done them at least 122 times.
Wow.
If not more.
Now that you've got your Keith voice warmed up, one of our listeners, my Laurie, said that she would love to hear the whole podcast with you using Keith's voice, but I know that's not going to be possible.
Well, it's a nice thought, but
right.
a little too much of a strain.
There's a ton of Keith fans out there, obviously, and you've made quite a legacy for that character. So can you tell us a little bit more about how Keith was developed?
Yes. You know, it's occurred to me over the years that a lot of the voices, the better known voices that I did, grew out of failed impressions. And sort of the genesis of the Keith voice is a character that Richard Crenna played in an old time radio show. And then later they morphed it into a television show called Armis Brooks. And it starred Eve Arden, and she played a high school teacher, and a then very young. Everybody knows who Richard Crenna is, right? Or maybe not.
Right. Well, he was in the Rambo movies.
Right. He was Colonel Troutman in the Rambo movies. But when he was a young man, he worked on this show, Our Miss Brooks, which ran in the 50s, and he played one of the high school students, Walter Denton.
Okay.
And I used to love to do an impression of Walter Denton. The thing was,
Walter kind of had a scratch in his voice that I couldn't quite capture. But that gives you some idea of where, gosh, Miss Brooks, what are we going to do about the prom? You know, this kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And fooling around with that, I sort of developed this silly voice I would do that I called Tommy Teenager. And he was kind of Walter Denton without the scratch. And then I sort of age him up just a wee bit, and now you've got the Keith voice. Just put a little more testosterone in there, add a little bit in the bottom, and there you go. There's the Keith voice. But it grew out of fooling around with that Richard Crenna character from the old radio show.
And how was Keith described to you before you came up with the voice?
Boy, it's so long ago.
Okay.
I suspect what happened is what normally happens when you show up to audition for an animated series. They will have several concept drawings of the character, and then they will have a paragraph or two of a description of the character, his various traits and foibles and what have you.
Right.
And you go from there. And I suppose it was like that. They probably had better artwork because, of course, Voltron was an already existing show. The huge difference between Voltron and any other animated series I worked on was this was an already existing show. We were essentially replacing the Japanese actors.
Right.
Voices. Most animation work, and it's funny, I never thought about it until Jack Angel pointed it out, who was another cast member in Voltron, that in voiceovers, in almost every other phase of the business, we're one of the last things that happens. If they're making a television commercial, by the time we come along, the picture's locked down, the music's in place, the sound effects, we do the voiceover, they mix it down, and it goes on the air. We're one of the last things that happens.
Okay.
But in animation, it's the reverse. Somebody obviously has to come up with an idea for a show, and then someone has to write a script. But after that's been done, the very next thing that happens is the actors go in the studio and record the voice tracks. And then the animators animate to those voice tracks. But with Voltron, they had essentially licensed a show that already existed, and we were just replacing the Japanese voices. So it was more, these were more like ADR sessions than standard animation sessions for us.
Right. So when you had like guys like Jameson Brewer and Mark Handler making up the lines for you, and you had to say the lines to a stopwatch, basically, right?
Yes, it was a... compared to the technology that exists now, it was kind of crude. I mean, essentially, some poor devil had to sit in the World Events production office with a stopwatch and time the lip movements for each line.
Right.
And then when we got the script, next to the line would be a number, 5.3 perhaps. And that indicated that you had 5.3 seconds in which to say this line. They would allow you to be a tenth short or a tenth long. In other words, it was, if 5.3 was the goal, you could come in at 5.2 or 5.4. But anything shorter or longer, you had to redo it.
Okay.
And over a long period of time, I began to come to the conclusion that it must be easier to express certain thoughts in Japanese. Because we would get a line, and it just wouldn't fit. Going as fast as I could, you know, a line that should have taken 8 seconds would take me 12 or 15. And I would say to the director, how the hell did the Japanese get this thought across in 8 seconds?
Wow.
You know, and I came to the conclusion that it must be easier to express yourself in a briefer way in Japanese than in English. Because that kept happening to us on a lot of cases. And then we would just simply have to rewrite the line on the fly, trying to figure out some way to get that thought across in 8 seconds.
Okay. We were talking about how the character Keith was developed. Can you also tell us how the character Pidge was developed?
Well, I can hardly describe it as a process of development. This was very early on in my voiceover career. I just didn't have the experience that I had later on. And so I should have been prepared for something like this, but I was sort of a novice. I had the Keith role. That's all I knew. I showed up to do the first session, and the director said, oh, by the way, we need you to do this other character, and shoved a picture under my nose. And he said, what do you got for this guy? And I immediately went into the panic mode and started flailing around. And virtually the first thing out of my mouth
was a voice that sounded like this.
And before I knew what was happening, he said, perfect, that's it.
Wow.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, well, no harm, no foul. This will be a character in one episode. But no, of course, it was a recurring character in every episode, which is something that all of us have learned over the years. Be very careful what you do in an audition, because you could end up having to do it in 65 or 125 episodes.
Right.
You know, I've had cases where in an audition, just to loosen things up, I will do something that I think is hideously inappropriate just to make them laugh and loosen, cut the tension, and then we can get down to work and really get the right voice for it. And to my horror, they will fall in love with this inappropriate character and say, no, 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 that's what we want. And then I'm stuck with it.
Okay. And when they also asked you to start doing some of the vehicle Voltron characters, which included characters that were sort of like Keith and Pidge, like Jeff and Chip.
Yeah, that really threw me. We're going to do what? And So what I tried to do was make them as different as I could, but still sort of the same, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I tried to separate them as much as I could, but you could only make them so different, you know?
Right.
Because they were very similar. And it was a very odd situation. And again, if I'd had a little more experience, it wouldn't have bothered me as much. But I had a few sleepless nights over these various characters and, having to do this stuff on the fly and worrying about whether it was going to work or not.
So the main reason you had sleepless nights was because you were trying to make sure it was the best it could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And again, I wasn't experienced enough to really judge if it was working or not. I had to kind of go on faith for a while.
Okay, so we've already had Franklin Kofod, Mark Handler, John Teichman, and Ted Koppler on the podcast. And they were all talking about your exceptional ability to voice multiple characters without being able to tell it was the same actor. Can you tell us your memories of those gentlemen? And then can you speak to how you developed your voice to make so many uniquely different characters?
Sure. Well, of the four folks that you mentioned, the one that I worked with for, I think, 50% of the episodes was Franklin Kofod.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a lot of fun to work with, very supportive, very friendly, never temperamental, never unpleasant. I mean, he was just a pleasure to work with. And the other episodes, as I recall, were directed by Peter Keefe, who has since passed away, and he was also great to work with. The other gentleman I didn't work with that much, so I can't speak to them.
Okay.
To any great degree. But it's nice to hear that they had nice things to say about me. You wanted me to talk about how I developed voices and characters and things like that?
That sounds so uniquely different.
Yeah, well, this is difficult to explain. Let me come at it a couple of different ways. You know, people say, how many voices do you do? And my answer to that is, I hope I never find out. I like to think there's a limitless cast in my throat. And what we do, Michael Bell, also a Voltron cast member,
right,
came up with a wonderful analogy for this. I can't think of anything better. He said, what we're doing is playing vocal Mr. Potato Head. You remember the game, Mr. Potato Head?
Oh, yeah. I had like two or three of those, and recently I had the Star Wars ones.
Okay. Well, so I guess everybody knows in the old days you actually used a real potato. Now they sell them with a sort of a plastic oval. But you plug mouths and mustaches and noses and eyes and various things onto this oval and create different faces.
Right.
And this is sort of what we're doing in our throats. You know, they say, well, he's an old man.
Well, is he an old man with a deep voice? Is he an old man with a high voice? Does he have an underbite?
And you can go on like that for ages.
Wow.
And so when people say, how many voices do you do? As I say, I try to hope I never find out. So that's sort of the game we play. But there are certain people who have, whose voices are so identifiable that it's difficult for them to double or triple.
Mm-hmm.
No matter, they make an effort. They're not without talent. It's just there's something about their voice that cuts through no matter what they do. And you say, oh, he's playing the old man. Oh, the same guy that played this is playing the old man. I can hear it. People like Michael Bell and myself and many others have what I, for lack of a better term, I call plastic or malleable voices. I'm able to get into areas where, unless you know me really well and have worked with me a lot, maybe you can spot me. But the average viewer, listener, is not going to say, wait a minute, the guy playing the banker is also playing the sheriff, you know?
Right.
I can come up with two different sounds, especially if they're not talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
If they're separated in different scenes, I can get away with it. Michael does it beautifully. So many others, Frank Welker, and on and on and on. I'm leaving people out because there's hundreds of them. But there are certain folks whose voices, well, I mentioned one guy because he's passed away, so I'm not going to screw up his career. Stanley Ralph Ross, no relation, although we used to joke that he was from the Russian Jewish branch of the Ross family, and I was from the Irish branch of the Ross family. But okay. He was a great big bear of a man. Most of his life he worked as a writer, but towards the end of his career, someone suggested he try voiceovers. And he had this big, I mean, he just naturally had a voice down in here. And he was great at playing villains, but when they tried to get him to double, no matter what he did, it came out like this, you know. And so, essentially, you hired him to play that one part. And maybe if there was like a one-line cop role, you might try take a chance with him. Right. Again, I'm not in any way denigrating the man. It's just he had such an identifiable voice that it was hard for him to double.
Right. All right. So, you've also worked with Lenny Weinrib, who is no longer with us.
Right.
And we haven't had too many people talk about what kind of a man Lenny Weinrib was. Would you be able to speak about that?
He was more like a force of nature. Watching him work was fascinating, although, you know, I don't have any idea what the hell I look like when I'm working. I don't think there's a great deal going on. But, I mean, Lenny would put his entire body into it, even if he was sitting down. Every line you would see muscles contorting, face, the whole thing. There was so much energy coming off this guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a lot of fun to work with because he was a character. I don't know how we got the show done, to be honest with you.
Franklin said that he used to want to do more takes than everybody else. Was that true?
Well, of course, you got to remember on Voltron, we worked separately. We did not work together, except very unusual situations. So I can't speak to Voltron. I just, you know, Lenny was one of these guys who never phoned it in. I mean, in this particular instance, he thought this was what we were doing was hysterically funny, and he kind of lost it for a while. But I mean, most of the time, he really took what he did seriously, and he worked incredibly hard, and he wanted it to be good, and he wanted it to be right. So I'm not surprised that he wanted more takes.
Okay.
You know, he was very conscientious.
Okay, so maybe we could go back in time a little bit to when you were growing up. What were your influences as a child, and did you grow up saying, I want to be an actor?
Never thought about, I'm trying to think if I ever thought about being an actor. I don't think I did. But the influences, we had no television in the home till I was about 12.
Okay.
So the majority of the media for me were the radio and this little record player that I had. And mostly radio, and I was very fortunate. In those years, I was in Canada, and the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, ran a lot of really good stuff. A lot of it they got from the BBC in England. And then we also heard the best of the stuff that was coming out of the United States. So I listened to a lot of radio drama, radio comedy, you name it. I was never interested in music until rock and roll came along. So I would tune out the music. I would just go and try to listen to anybody talking, even if I didn't understand what they were talking about. And I began to find myself fascinated with how different people's voices sounded. And if someone with a foreign accent was on, how interesting that sounded.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would begin to try to reproduce what I had heard. You know, it became almost a little hobby for me. I mean, some kids build model planes and, you know, some kids play baseball. I did too. But I, for some reason, fooling around with voices and accents just was something that I almost had a compulsion to do. And then one glorious evening, I stumbled upon The Goon Show. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
No, I haven't.
Well, it's an English show a BBC show, that starred a very young, then unknown Peter Sellers and a guy named Harry Secom and a guy named Spike Milligan, who wrote most of these episodes. And if anybody wants to go online, just put the Goon Show, G-O-O-N Show, into Google, and you'll find a website where you can listen to episodes. It's an amazing, amazing show. And Peter Sellers did somewhere between 10 and 15 different characters in this show. And I didn't understand a lot of it, but I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the fact, you know, we used to argue, because my parents would, well, my dad would listen to it. My mother had no use for it. The Goon Show is one of those very polarizing shows. You either get it or you don't. He got it, she didn't. So my dad and I would listen together, and we would argue about who was playing which character, and in some cases you could tell. But what fascinated me about it was how real these characters became. I mean, they were very exaggerated, cartoony characters, and yet, even though I knew one man was playing all these different parts, or two men, the characters became so real, you could see them in your mind's eye. And somehow I found that concept amazing. And shortly after that, I acquired a record album called the Grand Prix du Rock, which was a satire of radio coverage of sports car racing. I don't know who greenlighted this project. And it was done by Peter Ustinov.
Oh.
A prodigiously talented writer, actor, director, producer. And on this album, he played every part and did all the sound effects. I mean, it's all him.
Wow.
And again, he didn't change his voice that much. You could tell one man was doing all of this. But again, somehow the characters were so real and so believable that I began to see them in my mind's eye. And again, I was just struck by, wow, how an actor can make something so real for you.
With just his voice.
With just his voice, and perhaps not even changing his voice that much, just somehow being so locked into the character that he takes you along with him or her. And so those were the early influences, but I didn't do anything with it except, I started to learn how to do foreign accents listening to Peter Ustinov, because on that record he does Germans, he does Russians, French people, British, of course. He was also one of the first British people I heard who could do a very authentic American accent. Most of them couldn't in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Sellers was another one who could do a great American accent. And so really the only practical use I would make of any of this was if I needed a voice or an accent to punch up a dirty joke in the lunch court to crack up my evil little friends, I could do that. But the idea of doing this, you know, in any way that would make money or be a profession never occurred to me at that point in my life. It was just something that I had a compulsion to do.
So do you remember how you got your first role?
As far as voiceovers?
Yes.
Really, we should sort of back up and tell you how I got to that point.
Okay.
I mentioned that I liked rock and roll, and I did. I mean, I still remember being in the kitchen of a friend's home. I was about 11, 12 years old, and his older sister came in and turned the radio on and tuned in a particular station. It was CJAD in Montreal, and they were playing rock and roll 1 hour a day. And on came Little Richard singing Rip It Up, and I was transfixed. I just stood there in the kitchen saying, my God, this is what I've been waiting to hear my entire life. Somebody finally got it right. No more do I have to listen to Johnny Ray warbling about crying in the rain and Patty Page singing about how much is that doggy in the window and all that other stuff.
We were saying those same things when we got out of the disco era.
I saw a documentary on Lemmy Kilmister of Motorhead, And he said, I was talking to a younger musician, and I said, you know, the difference between you and me is I'm old enough to remember when there was no rock and roll. And let me tell you, it was effing horrible. And I watched that, and I said, I'm with you, Lemmy. I think we're about the same age. I remember, too. And years later, I met Little Richard, and I got to tell him that story. And I'm very glad that I did. But anyway, So here I am listening to the radio, listening to what passed for rock and roll in those days. And over time, I began to be fascinated by the disc jockeys, the guys who played this music. And I began to listen to what they did, how they wove the music together and read the commercials and did the weather forecasts and told jokes. And I thought, what a cool job, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with radio, and that's what I started out doing. I was a disc jockey and a production guy, and I did that for about 21, 22 years.
Wow.
But as the years rolled by, I began to become disenchanted with radio for a variety of reasons we don't need to go into at this point. And I began to hear about this voiceover business, which was a pretty well-known, pretty well-kept secret in those days. You didn't hear about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, I didn't even know it existed. But then I found out that it did exist, and that you had to either be in New York or Los Angeles in those days. That's no longer true. And so I thought, if I can wangle a radio job in Los Angeles and then sort of slyly segue out of radio and into voiceovers, that would be a hell of a plan. And that's essentially what I did.
That's cool.
I got to Los Angeles in 1978. I remained on the air for another 7 years. As soon as I hit town, I started going to workshops, acting classes, putting demos together, trying to get an agent, the whole thing. Finally got an agent, started making the rounds, doing the auditions. It took me about 5 years before I thought, boy, I think I have a voiceover career going now. Because I suddenly realized I was making about twice the money outside the radio station as inside the radio station.
Oh.
And in 1985, I gave notice at the radio station where I was working at the time, and that was the end of my radio career. I never looked back. So how did I get the first animated job?
Right.
The first animation job that I can recall was going in and doing some incidental voices for Wally Burr in a Spider-Man series he was doing in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
And in that case, I did not audition for that. Wally was a good friend of my agent, the late lamented Donna Lee Davies. And he just called her up and said, listen, I need a guy who can give me three different voices for some incidental roles. Who do you have? And she said, well, why don't I send this Neil Ross guy over? And that's when I met Wally Burr. And that was, I think, the out-and-out first animation work I ever did. And then shortly after that, I had done a general audition at Hanna-Barbera. And Ginny McSwain cast me in an episode of Richie Rich, playing a pushy salesman who gets his tie caught in the door. And those were the first two that I recall doing, and I didn't specifically audition for either one. In those days, Hanna-Barbera had this wonderful deal that I guess Gordon Hunt had instituted. In the spring, when they were starting to put the shows together for the next season, the network shows, if you had never worked at Hanna-Barbera and had never auditioned at Hanna-Barbera, you could come in, and they would give you 5 minutes, and you could do anything you wanted for 5 minutes. And
wow.
They would listen to that, and then based on that, they might cast you in a show as a guest, you know, or which is what happened to me.
Sounds like something SNL did.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, for a long time, Hanna-Barbera just hired the same people over and over again, and you could understand why. I mean, they were tremendously talented people.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of had a little stock company. You know, Dawes Butler and June Foray and folks like that.
Mm-hmm.
Joni Gerber, Lenny. I think Lenny was part of that. And, I mean, they did a fabulous job. But when Gordon came in, he said, you know, the business is changing. We need to get some new folks in. And he instituted this policy where you could come in and do 5 minutes. And if they liked what they heard, you had a chance to get in a little bit.
Okay. And then how did that roll into Voltron?
Prior to Voltron, I'd have to look it up, but I landed a regular part at Hanna-Barbera in Pac-Man. And that show ran for 2 years. I was in that playing Clyde, one of the ghost monsters. And then I also landed a show called Pandemonium, which was about some panda bears. That only lasted one season. And then I got the call around that time to audition for Voltron. And that happened at a place called the Voicecaster, which is still in existence in Burbank.
Wow.
It was the first place in Los Angeles that exclusively cast voices. Prior to that, you either went to the advertising agency to read or casting places that mostly dealt with on-camera casting would have some sort of a throw-together voiceover casting session. It would be, you know, some guy would bring in a $10 tape recorder and scotch tape the microphone to the wall, and it was all very poorly done because basically they were on camera people. They weren't voiceover people. So a guy named Bob Lloyd, seeing this opportunity, said, I'm going to open a place that just casts voices. Mm-hmm. And he cleverly named it the Voicecaster. And that's where they held the auditions for Voltron. So I went in, and I don't really have a memory of that audition. I vaguely remember going in there, but I can't tell you exactly what happened. I assume, as I said, they had some concept drawings and a paragraph of character description, and that's what I worked off of.
Okay, so once you started the job, how many days a week would you say you were going in for the Voltron session, since it was a daily show?
Right. Well, they were trying to get, all the episodes in the can as fast as possible. My memory of it is we worked twice a week. I may be wrong on that. I don't know what the other folks have told you. But it seems like about twice a week we would get called in.
Okay. And your sessions would be how many hours?
Well, it would depend mostly on how many lines you had and how many takes it took to get those lines. You know, I alluded to the timing situation.
Right.
So, I mean, a lot of times you'd do a line and Franklin would say, boy, that's absolutely perfect. I loved it, but it's 3/10 of a second long. All right, do it again.
Nope.
Oh, now you're 2/10 of a second short. Try it again.
Wow.
You know, now as time wore on, and I'm sure this is true for all the other actors, we got to be pretty damn good at shaving 1/10 of a second. You know, on some really long speeches. I mean, sometimes the long ones were the real killers. You know, a 22-second line.
But
with a lot of energy in it. I mean, you bang it out and they go, boy, that's perfect. I love it, but it's 3/10 long. You ramp up and do it again. Now you're 2/10 short. Sometimes it was really frustrating, but it surprised me once we got up to speed how often we could nail it in one or two takes.
Yeah, there were those monologues that Keith had at the end of some of the episodes where he would talk about, you know, as long as there's Voltron, the defender of the universe, to protect us, you know, he would go on and on.
Yeah. Yes, those were the bane of my existence because I had to please Madam Stopwatch.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we got it done.
Right. And then as you were going along with the show, and some of the shows started airing, and then they started becoming popular. Were you guys in any position to like renegotiate or anything, or did anything happen at any point because of the popularity of the show for you guys?
No, I mean, we had a pretty good deal going in. And my memory is that we had most of it done by the time it got on the air and began to be successful. There weren't that many episodes left to do.
Okay.
So, no, there was no renegotiation or anything like that. But, you know, I think we're all quite happy with the deal we had. My only regret is I understand there was some talk about doing a feature film, and it ended up not happening. And I think that was a huge mistake. I think if they had done a feature film at that point, they would have done great.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But for one reason or another, that never got green-lighted, so.
Okay, well, did you ever have any of that Voltron merchandise that everybody was clamming for back in the day?
I do now. When I did the video game, they presented me with a Voltron action figure, which I still have. But no, I didn't run out and buy any of the toys.
Okay, well that video game was just like 3 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
The THQ video game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you got reunited with Michael Bell and BJ Ward for that, right?
Yeah, that's right. They had a big rollout and invited us to the studio, and we did, I think, a televised podcast.
Yeah, I remember watching it. It was on Twitch TV.
All right.
But yeah, that was something that was pretty special because it reunited you guys. Had you guys ever come together at any other point for anything other than that?
Well, I think we would sort of bump into each other making the rounds. In the case of Michael, I've worked with Michael and BJ too, on many different shows. Because Michael was in G.I. Joe, so was I. Michael was in Transformers, so was I. I think BJ was in both of those shows, too. So, and then, you know, making the rounds, auditions here, there, and everywhere, you're constantly bumping into folks like that. And Jack Angel was in Transformers and G.I. Joe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Lenny was, for some reason.
We know this probably won't happen, but if you guys were brought back for a Voltron anniversary, would it be any weird for you, or would it be really, would you be rejoicing over this if you were able to reunite with like Peter and Michael and BJ and Jack and yourself?
Sure. That would be a lot of fun. I would look forward to it. You know, my only concern when I did that game was, could I still do those voices?
Yeah. And we found out you could.
Yeah. Maybe I should have done the entire interview as Keith. I don't know. It's just it's hard to sustain a voice and think at the same time, you know, without a script, it gets difficult.
Well, we have a bunch of fans that have brought some questions for you. And if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you the fans questions now. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. We have Casey Snyder, who wants to know, we know you as Keith and Pidge, which are pretty iconic, but what would you say was your most memorable role of all time?
Well, Keith and Pidge were pretty memorable. Remember, that was the first lead role I had in a major series, and that's not something that you forget ever.
Right.
So I love those guys. That said, the characters that interest me most are characters who are somewhat conflicted, and that's why I loved playing Shipwreck in G.I. Joe, because everybody in that show was either real, real good or real, real bad, but Shipwreck wanted to do the right thing, but he didn't like following orders, so he was constantly conflicted, constantly getting into trouble. And I found that a very rewarding experience playing that character. It was also fun to do Norman Osborn and the Green Goblin in Spider-Man. Just fun to cut loose and be insane for a while.
I guess you'd have to be.
When doing the Green Goblin part, it's very liberating to just let it fly, you know.
There was a lot of high-pitched laughing and cackling, too, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. So those are a couple that come to mind.
Okay.
But I never will forget the thrill of landing that those lead roles in Voltron. Huge moment in my life.
That's great. Mylari asks, when you were tapped to do one and eventually more of the voices on Voltron, did you have any idea the show would become, both in terms of popularity at the time and later as a minor cultural reference, or that it would teach a generation that a team could be made from any combination of people based simply on personality and ability, like the who you are inside versus outside thing?
I don't think any of us had any thought that these shows would be remembered at all in 25 or 30 years. The prevailing wisdom at the time was we have the audience for a 2 or 3 year window when they're sort of tweens, but they will outgrow the show and their younger brothers and sisters will not want that show. They'll want their own show. And so the shelf, you know, the life of most of these shows is 2 or 3 years and then done. And they go up on a shelf and no one will ever look at them again or think about them again. That was the prevailing wisdom at the time.
Right. So you were brought back several years later in the 90s, like 97, for Voltron the Third Dimension.
Well, that amazed us. I mean, there's, in my entire career, there's only two shows that were ever brought back. Voltron and then Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, which featured another character I loved to play, the newsman, Whitley White. Nobody seems to remember that, but I had a hell of a lot of fun.
Can you give us a rendition of him?
The show took place in a mythical little town in California, and Whitley White was the local newsman, and he appeared to be the only person who was on radio or television in this little town. Anytime anyone turned a radio on, Whitley White was broadcasting. Anytime someone turned on a television, there would be Whitley White. And sometimes Whitley White would throw it to himself in the field. He would say, and here with an on-the-spot report is Whitley White. Thank you, Whitley. He would suddenly, you know. And I sort of, again, another failed impression. Whitley White was me trying to do a local L.A. Newscaster named George Putnam, who had one of these stentorian voices and was very much in love with the sound of it, you could tell. And when I would do Whitley White, it was so well written, it was so much fun, that I was on the verge of cracking up virtually the whole time. And I look back on those sessions very fondly, but unfortunately, nobody seems to remember the show. But it did get brought back after a couple of years. But that and Voltron were the only two that ever came back. Everything else, when it's over, it's over.
Okay.
Just to amplify on the answer, the thing that keeps happening to a lot of us when we go out and to conventions and sign autographs and start meeting people is you will have people come up to you and tell you some really touching stories about how these shows helped them through a rough time in their life, changed their lives for the better, gave them inspiration to do things. I recently had a guy say, because of shipwreck, I joined the Navy, and I didn't know whether to dive under the desk at that point.
Wow.
But it worked out great. I had a great career in the Navy, and it's all thanks to you. Michael Bell tells similar stories about people who joined the military because of the character Duke in G.I. Joe. And fortunately, it worked out well for them. I've had people come up and say, you know, I had a horrible home situation when I was growing up, and somehow your show gave me something to hang on to, and I decided to go ahead and finish high school and go on to college because somehow from your show, I got the idea that if you work hard and stick to it, you can succeed. And I mean, it's amazingly touching, some of the stories that you hear. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we had any idea at the time that potential was there, but I'm very glad that it was.
We actually had a podcast episode that Ted Koppler was on. And as a part of that podcast, we had done a contest because we were getting very close to 10,000 listens on the podcast. So the contest was for you to comment on a post and say, you know, your thank you to Ted Koppler for bringing us Voltron, you know, all those years ago. And, you know, if he was standing right in front of you, what would you say? And then several of those people did exactly what you just said. They described situations as they were growing up. They were being bullied, or, you know, they used Voltron as a way to make it through things, you know, that they were having a hard time with in their life and stuff like that. So to this day, people say Voltron was very inspirational to them.
Yes, I've heard many of those stories myself. It's very touching. It's quite moving.
Right.
To be honest with you.
All right. We have another listener. Stanley Ryan Domer asks, "Hey Pidge, what was with the hairband?"
I haven't the faintest idea. Ask the animators. I just threw the voice.
So did the hairband come into play when you were deciding what his voice was going to sound like?
No, I was in this panic mode. My God, I won't come up with anything and they'll fire me. I don't think so. No.
Okay. All right. This question by Ryan Denning, and he would ask, who would you cast as six pilots in the Voltron movie? And I guess they're including Sven with the six.
Boy, I don't know. The thing is, whenever they reboot a franchise, they change it radically.
Right.
I keep hearing rumors of a Voltron feature film, and trust me, I know nothing, boys and girls, but other than rumors people share with me. But if that were to come to pass, they would change the whole thing radically. It would not look or sound anything like what we did. In fact, it might be so different, the only thing they would keep would be the name.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, so you saw what Michael Bay did with Transformers.
Right, I did.
And, you know, a very different look and concept. I'm very happy for Peter Cullen that he got to continue to do Optimus Prime. But
mm-hmm.
other than that, you know, he went in a completely different direction, Michael Bay. And it paid off. I mean, they've made a fortune with those movies.
Right.
So I have a feeling if there's a Voltron feature, the major changes will happen.
Okay. All right. Gregory Tyler asks, Line Force pilots Keith and Pidge look and sound similar to Vehicle Team pilots Jeff and Chip.
They did?
Which of these characters did you portray first, and did your portrayals of the earlier characters affect how you portrayed the later characters?
Well, Keith and Pidge came first, and then suddenly they broke the news that about, I forget what the percentage was, but a certain percentage of the episodes featured these other characters who were the same but not the same. The later characters, as I said, were an attempt by me to make them different, but not totally different. They had to, because they were, how do I say this? They were so similar. So you were walking this fine line of just making them slightly different instead of radically different.
Right.
But Keith and Pidge came first. The other two guys were just, they became not Keith and not Pidge.
All right. And there's a couple questions here that follow the third dimension. When you returned to voice Keith for Voltron the Third Dimension, did you approach the role differently than you did in the 80s?
No, I don't think so. No, I was trying to maintain that same flavor, that same feel, that same sound. Obviously, the picture changed dramatically, but...
Right.
You know, that's nothing that I had any influence over, so...
Right, but the stories were pretty much the same because Mark Handler was still doing the writing.
Mm-hmm. I think I was a somewhat better actor by then.
Okay.
Because I had, I forget, you know, another 10 or 15 years under my belt.
Right, that makes sense.
But no, I just tried to bring back the same sound and feeling and flavor that the original character had, because people seemed to like that.
All right, and then when you also discovered that Billy West would be doing Pidge, what were your thoughts on that?
I like Billy a lot. He's fun. So I thought, if I have to give up a character to get Billy into the studio, that's fine with me.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
You know, if they had wanted to replace Keith, then I might have had a problem with it.
Okay. You also, didn't you do the robotic character Amalgamus?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. What was influencing your decision on the Amalgamus character?
Oh, it's sort of an all-purpose prissy English voice, as I recall. It's been a while since I've done it. But yeah, it's sort of my all-purpose prissy English voice.
Okay. With mainstream celebrities now performing in many animated feature films and even television series, is it more difficult to win roles today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we plane rap people, as I call us, never even get to try to work in a feature film. Maybe an incidental role, but I mean, all the major roles are gone. We never even get to audition for it. The celebrities are... there's somewhat fewer celebrities in the television end of it, but a few. So yeah, it's eaten into our work, sure.
Okay. Here's an interesting question that affects me too. Podcasts offer a new venue for radio-like dramas. What are your thoughts about the creative and commercial viability of podcasts and other internet-enabled audio and video offerings?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I started out in a world where, you know, there was television and the movies, and it was really tough to break in. But if you did, you were a big star and everything was great. And now I'm in a world where everybody's in show business. You know, some guy can hook a camera up in his bedroom and do a silly dance in a silly costume and throw it up on YouTube, and millions of people may fall in love with it and want to watch it. You might have had a great idea for a radio show, but nobody would put it on the air, or a television show. Now you can do it. You can put it out as a podcast. But how do you make money with some of this stuff? That's the thing. How do you make a living being on YouTube? How do you make a living doing a podcast?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty difficult.
And how do people find you?
Right.
You know, my daughter has a podcast she listens to on a regular basis, and she tells me about it, and it sounds quite intriguing. You're going to ask me what it is, and I've forgotten, but I think, how the hell does anyone find this?
Right.
Because, again, you know, when I was a kid, television was channels 2 through 13, and that was it.
We had 6 channels.
And in a lot of smaller towns, you didn't have all those channels filled. You had maybe 2 channels or 3. So you could figure out what was on television in about, 30 seconds. And that was it. If you didn't like any of that, well, shut the TV off. There's nothing else. Now you have this virtually limitless world of YouTube and podcasting and the internet. But how the hell does anybody find anything? That's the part that, how do you promote that? How do you let the world know that this particular podcast is happening? And here's what you got to do to hear it.
I think people just search based on their interests. And if they find something, they try it out. And if they like it, they keep listening to it. And if they don't, then they move on to something else.
Yeah. So it's this strange situation. Now almost anybody who wants to can try to do something, but you can't. It's tough to make a buck with it.
Right. Mark Oliver asks, what was your most challenging project and also one you're most proud of?
Challenging. Well, I think probably the most pressure I've ever felt in show business was being the announcer on the Academy Awards in 2003. A tremendous amount of pressure. There's a lot on the line. If you screw up, you're not only screwing up in front of millions of viewers, you're also screwing up in front of the cream of Hollywood who are sitting out in the theater,
right,
watching and listening. And also, you have no control over anything as the announcer. When I was a disc jockey, if I got in trouble on the air, I could throw a record on and fall back and regroup and try to figure out what went wrong and how to fix it. In voiceovers, we're not live. You roll in and I think I'll nail this on take 7 or possibly 8. But a live telecast like the Academy Awards, you got one shot at it, and you have no control over anything. I mean, you've got a headphone on, and you're listening for a voice that says, "Stand by, announce, announce, go," and that's you. And you got to be ready, and you got to know what the hell to say when you're supposed to say it. And as I say, you have the potential of making an idiot out of yourself in front of millions of people in the cream of Hollywood. So that was the most challenging. What am I proudest of? Oddly enough, my narration work comes to mind. I did 22, 23 Novas for public television. I'm very proud of those. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud of a show that I did, that I narrated, called Sugihara, A Conspiracy of Kindness, which I think you can find on YouTube, and I think you can also purchase it. It's the story of a Japanese diplomat who saved the lives of 2,000 Jews in Lithuania in World War II.
Wow.
At great peril to himself. And you ask, how in Hades does a Japanese diplomat end up saving Jews in Lithuania? Well, there's one hell of a story. And I'm very proud to have been chosen to narrate that story.
Okay.
If you want to look it up, it's Sugihara, A Conspiracy of Kindness.
Well, thank you. Claire Kaltman asks, what was the most funniest moment you remember happening during the recording of Voltron?
Funny in retrospect, embarrassing at the time. As I said, we didn't work together. We worked separately because we were working against a stopwatch, so you couldn't really play full scenes or anything like that. But on this one occasion, I came in and Michael Bell was finishing up, and Franklin Kofod said, Michael, would you mind hanging around and working with Neil? I've got something I need you guys to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turned out that this episode featured mice and simpering princesses, and he wanted us to do both of these things. So we said, simpering princesses. Well, there's no budget for any women actors, so you're going to have to do it.
Oh, boy.
So we spent, I don't know, a half hour, 45 minutes either doing this, which was the mice, or going, you know, and Michael and I are looking at each other, two middle-aged guys in a room going, it was embarrassing, but in retrospect, very funny. I wish somebody had filmed it or taped it.
Was somebody else holding their mouth to keep from cracking up?
Well, the guys in the control room were falling on the floor. You know, uh-huh. You couldn't hear them because they're behind the glass. But
oh, that's great.
I think we weren't laughing, but if you'd been there, you would have.
All right, so we've gotten to the ends of the questions that the fans had. So I just wanted to close this up a little bit with a question for you. What did it really mean for you to work as a character, as a voice actor, for something like Voltron that has lasted for over 30 years now, and it has become such a big part of people's lives, even though it hasn't been out there consistently?
You're asking, what does it mean to me now, or what did it mean to me at the time?
What does it mean to you now, after the 30 years?
Well, it is... it's a wonderful gift, you know. You don't think about it when you're younger, but when you get older, it's like, will anybody remember me and what I did? And as I mentioned earlier, I spent the first 22 years of my career as a disc jockey, and that job is writing on water. I mean, once it's over, and nobody remembers. Maybe a handful of people. Oh, yeah, he used to be on K-Blow or whatever. I think mm-hmm. I heard him once. Nobody remembers. I have friends, marvelously talented, gifted people who work their tails off. And it's like, it's almost as though it never happened. You know, there's a handful of old radio people who remember and email each other and go to various websites, but these wonderful careers and nobody remembers. But here I have in Voltron, in Transformers, in G.I. Joe, something that people remember and care about and are interested in after all these years. And people are willing to fly us to conventions so they can meet us and talk to us and ask questions about the shows. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful gift. And I think I speak for everybody in the show, at least all the folks that I've had a chance to talk to. We're very grateful that these shows are remembered. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to have happened to us.
Well, I have to tell you, last year at RetroCon, when I met you and interviewed you there, I have to say that was a really big geek moment for me. Because it was really special being able to meet, you know, the voice of the original Keith and Pidge.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, it's a big moment for me to think that somebody wants to go to the trouble of coming to one of these things and setting up equipment just to talk to little old me. I never thought anything like that would happen.
Yeah, well, there were people that were coming to you at RetroCon, and they were coming to the desk that you were sitting at, and I could see the looks on their faces. Hey, that guy did the voice of Keith. That guy did the voice of Pidge. You know, and they knew the show. They knew, you know, the actors. And that was something you didn't get a chance to do when you were actually doing the show, because nobody knew who the voice actors were back then. Now, today, everybody knows.
The whole business was a very, very well-kept secret. I don't think anybody, for devious reasons. It's just, at that time, nobody seemed to know we existed. And obviously that's changed dramatically. Possibly because celebrities began to do this kind of work. So it was a double-edged sword. They took work away from us, but they made us more visible. I don't know.
Right. Well, did you get a chance to see there was a documentary done by John DiMaggio called I Know That Voice? Did you get to see
that? No, I never saw that. I've heard about it, but I've never seen it.
I actually think Jack Angel was either in it or at the premiere for it.
Very possibly. As I say, people have referenced it. I understand it ran here in town at a theater. I'm not sure what the ultimate goal is, whether they're going to try to roll it out as a feature or...
Well, I think the whole idea was to celebrate those people who were voice actors who have done these characters that everybody loves, but nobody knew who the people behind those characters were. And it gave a face to those names.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that that's happening.
I have to say that every time my wife and I watch a movie that's animated, we always listen in to the voices and we try to identify them even before we get to know who actually did the characters. And that's always a fun game to play.
Sure, absolutely. It's an interesting thing that the voice actor could become a little bit of a celebrity.
Right.
You know, and I often wonder, do we enhance your experience? I suppose we must. I mean, we're just human beings. We can't sort of live up to the character we played. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand.
I am not Springer. I am not Shipwreck.
Right.
But I used to, when I was working on Transformers, and I would be at a social event, and there would be kids present, and someone would say, you know, that guy works on Transformers. They'd come running over, and of course, they'd all want to know about Optimus Prime. And they'd say, what's the guy like who plays Optimus Prime? Is he a big guy? I said, big? He's about 7 feet tall. You know, I wasn't going to tell them the truth, because I don't know if I'm giving away any trade secrets here, but Peter Cullen is a little less than 7 feet tall.
Yeah, we actually had Dan Jolly on the program, and he met him, and he said he's shorter than he would think.
Well, he ain't 7 feet.
Right.
I'll say that. That's all I'll say. But, you know, I didn't want to burst their bubble. But I guess when you become an adult, you know that when you meet Peter, you're not going to see Optimus Prime.
Right.
So I guess it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that Franklin said when they were making the show was that they just moved on from show to show to show. They never really went back and took a look at what they did because it was always the next show that was the next job, you know?
Yes, I would say most of people listening probably saw more Voltron episodes than I ever did.
Right. Did you actually get a chance to see any episodes?
Every show I do, well, in a lot of cases, you're almost finished recording before the first one even gets on the air because there's such a time lag between the time they're recorded and the time the animation is finished. But I always make it a point of watching one or two episodes just in case there's something going on visually that I need to know about. But actually, you know, we were working a lot in those days, and these shows all aired in the daytime.
Right.
And I forget when I finally broke down and bought a VCR. But, you know, for a long time, I didn't have any way to record these shows. And when they were on the air, I was out working on something else.
Right, of course.
So it was hard to even watch them if you wanted to. So I have seen some, but certainly not every episode, no.
And did you cringe?
No, I mean, this was an acting thing. And I cringe more when I'm in an interview thing and ad-libbing.
Ah, okay.
No, I've gotten to where I'm fairly good at cold-bloodedly analyzing a performance and saying that worked, that didn't, you know. But I'm not cringing.
Okay. All right, well, I want to thank you for joining me on the Let's Voltron podcast. I have to let you know again that as our podcast, we have listeners that are from over 66 different countries. And we get people from the Philippines, people from China, people from Japan, people from UK, United States, you know, Australia, all over. Mm-hmm. And they are all big fans of yours.
Oh, well, bless their hearts. It, you know, it's very, very gratifying to, after many long years of doing many, many things, to have some things that folks remember and revere. It's a treasure. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me on Let's Voltron. Have a very good night.
All right, Mark, thank you very much, and good night.
Breaking news, Voltron fans. We know some of you have seen a giant Voltron statue on Facebook and Twitter. On Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast, we have the scoop on this. If you recall back to our previous episode when we had Bob Coppler on as our guest, he mentioned they were planning to have a Voltron statue placed somewhere in St. Louis to honor the hometown hero for his 30th anniversary. Here's the details. Just yesterday, Thursday, August 14th, 2014, the same statue that was on display originally at San Diego Comic-Con in 2012, measuring 15 feet tall, with a gigantic light-up blazing sword, was placed on the second floor of the St. Louis Science Center. As of right now, plans are to keep it there until the end of September. So if you're in St. Louis in the next 6 weeks, you gotta go to the St. Louis Science Center and get a picture with the big guy. When you get your picture, send it to the official Voltron account on Twitter, at Voltron, and make sure you use hashtag Voltron30 on the tweet. You never know, you might be in line for a prize, especially if you're decked out in full Voltron gear, and then you could send us the picture at Let's Voltron on Twitter and be entered into the Show Us Your Voltron contest. You recall from last week's episode, we talked to Chris Wofford from Acid Free Gallery, and he said he would sponsor the Show Us Your Voltron contest. So you have a chance to win a limited edition Voltron metal print for a 30th anniversary edition that's coming out on September 10th. All you have to do is send us a picture of you in your Voltron gear. Show us your Voltron. We'll be able to have Chris on the program, on the podcast, on September 10th, and he will pick the winner from all the entries of all the pictures. Now, we also have some people over at welovefine.com
who are looking for your help. They have a Voltron fan design contest. They've completed the design submission period and are in a rating period now. There's some great designs, and the top winners will have their designs turned into officially licensed Voltron shirts. Now, if you think you would like your voice to be heard on which design you think should win, you can go to contest.welovefine.com/contest and look for the Voltron emblem. Go in there, and you'll be able to see all the different designs that people have submitted, and you'll get to rate them on a score of 1 to 5. Don't forget also that 80s Tees has 4 new designs of Voltron t-shirts that they'll have on sale in their store. So go to 80stees.com and look at the 4 new designs of Voltron t-shirts. We'll have them up on the notes page from this podcast. I also wanted to take a moment to thank Neil Ross for talking to us on Let's Voltron. And while we're at it, we have just enough time to ask 2 members of the Voltron Force one question. Commander Keith, what is your favorite podcast?
Let's Voltron!
And Pidge, same question. What is your favorite podcast?
Let's Voltron!
You heard it here, folks. Even the Voltron Force listens to this podcast for all the latest in the world of Voltron. Exclusive interviews, episode reviews, reports from the conventions, the latest Voltron merchandise, contests, and more. So if you haven't already, go out to iTunes and Stitcher, rate the podcast, and leave a review to let others know what you think about the program. And subscribe, too. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on...
Let's Voltron!